Welcome to Local Motion. I'm Corey Stanton. A few weeks ago, I attended the 7th annual Western Colorado Food and Farm Forum in Montrose. While I was there, I had the opportunity to speak with farmers Ben Hartman, author of the book The Lean Farm, and also the one and only Joel Salatin from Polyface Farms. You may also know Joel from numerous food documentaries such as Food Inc., and most recently, Farmers for America. Ben Hartman of Clay Bottom Farm has been focused on farming vegetables and also extreme efficiency. Over the years, Ben and his farm have adopted what's known as lean manufacturing. Traditionally, lean manufacturing or lean production was used primarily for corporate manufacturing. But after experimenting with this system on his farm and its focus on systematic methods for waste minimization, Ben Hartman has a very dialed-in approach to farming. He now has two books out and even a lean farm school where he offers online courses. Here's Ben talking about his lean farming process.
You might summarize it by saying you start with the customer and work backwards from the customer. And with commodity crop farming, you usually don't know who the end user is, who's eating those corn and soybeans, and we don't have a connection to the customer. So lean says that we're going to actually start with the customer, and we're going to produce what the customer wants. And we're going to deliver when they want it and in the amount they want. It opens up all kinds of opportunities to sell food to local people regionally, because actually there's a lot of meals being eaten in Colorado on a daily basis. There's just a lot of food that needs to be grown and produced here, but there's been this disconnect with the customer. In Kaizen, and would be a Japanese term that refers to continuous improvement. So the idea is that you often go to farm conferences and you take notes and you want to go home and set up the perfect farm. And actually, that's not how it works. The marketplace is constantly changing. Customer tastes are constantly changing. Climate patterns are constantly changing. And so we need to constantly change how we farm, what we produce, and how we do it. So Kaizen is a method for making that happen. And in essence, it would say that every year you get more specific in identifying what your customer values. Okay, you deepen that relationship every year. So it means different types of interacting, ways of interacting with customers. Number two would be every year you get more decluttered on your farm. Lean system offers a beautiful 5S organization system, and it totally works on farms too. And a lot of farms, especially when you're in transition mode, you need to declutter and clean up, and you need smooth flow on your farm. And you can't have smooth flow if you're tripping over hoses and tools and supplies that you don't really need. And so Kaizen offers a method to get your farm organized and keep it organized in the long run too. And then waste reduction. And so lean obviously has this very strong emphasis on finding the waste, they call it muda, and eliminating it. And there's 7 types of muda, and they're in every single workplace, including on farms. And so what are the types of muda, types of waste that are most prevalent on farms? How do we get rid of them? And then how do we do it on a yearly basis so that every year farming gets easier to do and more profitable?
It sounds like you've achieved this lean system. Mm-hmm. I'm sure it's ever evolving. What was that transition like, or how long did that?
Yeah, we were working like 60 to 80 hours a week. At this point, we work about 30 to 35 hours a week. And that feels like the right amount for right now. And it took us a good 4 to 5 growing seasons to get to that point. The first thing we did is we had hay wagons. I borrowed some of my dad's hay wagons, and we just sent hay wagon loads of surplus materials, row covers and tools and all this junk we picked up at auctions that we'd stuffed our barns with, and just sent it off the property. We picked out a few tools that we actually needed and were using, multi-purpose tools that were high-quality tools, and we got rid of everything else, and it made a huge difference. So that's the first thing I would recommend doing, is just identify the tools that actually add value to your product and get rid of everything else if you can. I know we have emotional attachment to heirlooms and antiques. And so it's generational too. So the World War II generation, the task of their generation was to not throw a single shoestring away. That's how they survived the Great Depression. And the task of our generation is editing, constant editing, what comes into our house, what comes onto our farms. And so lean, like I said, has this 5S system that gives you a process to do that editing. It boils down essentially to identify the tools that you're using. Usefulness is the key metric. Which tools get touched and used, and keep them and store them in the middle of your farm at easy to reach locations. The leanfarmschool.com has lots of free videos and resources, and there's an online course. And then my two books would be The Lean Farm and The Lean Farm Guide to Growing Vegetables. If you are a vegetable producer and want to dive deeply into my production techniques, that's what that book is about.
Next, I had the chance to speak with Joel Salatin. Joel is a farmer, writer, speaker, and self-proclaimed lunatic. He is also lovely to chat with. The full interview will be available at kvnf.org. Here's Joel talking about the early days on his farm.
It sounds like growing up, your family's farming style was maybe a little bit non-traditional or non-conventional. Do you think that shaped how you farm today?
Oh, absolutely. I'm cut from a really unconventional lunatic cloth. My grandfather, my dad's dad, was a charter subscriber to Rodale's Organic Gardening and Farming magazine when it was launched in, 1949 by Rodale. And so he had a large organic garden and chickens and things like that. A lot of people in this country now don't realize what a watershed that just post-World War II period was as we moved away from heritage techniques and embraced the new cheap chemicals that were available as a kind of a result of the extra stockpile of the war effort. And so, there was a healthy group of people. I mean, Lewis Bromfield was one. He was up for Secretary of Agriculture, and he certainly didn't use chemicals. And then he died suddenly. Some people still think he was assassinated, but anyway, I won't go to conspiracy theories. The point is that there was a lot of searching about that post-World War II period of time. And my grandpa came down on the side of the non-chemical. And Dad got it from him. I got it from Dad. And so I'm absolutely, still running that same idea. Today, I mean, you have the philosophy or the paradigm, if you will, and then you have the practical outworking of that paradigm. That initial paradigm of we don't use chemicals and we're carbon-based and we're, complex, integrated, multi-speciated based, those kinds of things. What we've done now over the period of time is we've simply refined that and added more species or more efficient ways to a bigger wood chipper, for example, to do carbon, to do larger composting, and added, the chickens behind the cows and more complex symbiotic relationships that just never stop. You never get done adding additional things. We just had this winter, for example, a new idea. We have a bandsaw mill so we can turn our own logs into lumber we use on the farm. And we've made some 4-foot high tables for the hoop houses. So in the winter, the laying chickens come into tall tunnel hoop houses so they stay warm and water doesn't freeze. You've got all this headroom. You've got chickens on the deep bedding on the floor, but you've got all this headroom. Well, can we use the headroom? And so we've now made 4-foot tall, just wooden tables, 4 by 8 feet, and we can just set them together and essentially make a mezzanine floor. Okay, we put all the chickens up there, and then we can run lambs underneath sheep, and the sheep run on the floor underneath the mezzanine. All the real fragile chicken waterers and feeders and nest boxes and stuff is up on this mezzanine. The chickens can jump up there, and it allows you to get two tiers, two additional production, because now you're using cubic footage and not just linear floor space. So, you never get done refining. There's always another refinement that you can do.
What do you know now that you wish you knew back then?
I would say whenever anybody asks me that kind of question, like what would you do differently or whatever, I think the main thing that I would do differently, which is the Achilles heel of pretty much all farmers, so, I'm pretty typical that way, is to appreciate the strength in mutual interdependence and not go so long before finding partners that are strong where I'm weak. The whole business strengths finder idea where, you've been told, well, you're weak in that, you should work on that. The whole strengths finder idea flips that on its head and says, actually, you get a lot farther if you get a partner who is strong where you're weak and let you spend more time honing, refining, and leveraging your strength. And I would say that if I had to do over again, I would have sought and found and developed a team faster so it wasn't just me. And I think that's pretty much true for every small business. The industrial economy pushed us to the economies of scale and size of everything. And there is a point at which size starts becoming top heavy. We see it in business. We see it in government. We see it in lots of things. And there is a sweet spot. There's a sweet spot of scale for different kinds of businesses in different fields. We've certainly seen it in, for example, the movie industry. 80 years ago, there were just several large film producers, and the average company had whatever it was, 1,000 employees. Today, there are hundreds You know, everybody that's got an iPhone can produce a movie, right? And hundreds, and the average production team is 10. And so that's a perfect example of kind of the uberization, atomization in the marketplace. The point is that the desire for millennials and for young people to connect with food, connect with their farmer, know their farmer, that pendulum is definitely swinging in favor of atomization within the food system. And so who are you going to dance with? So we've got a changing of partners. We're not just dancing with Kroger anymore. We're dancing with actual, you know, people with a face.
I tried to watch Food Inc. and I did watch it. But what's changed for you since you did that film?
That film, Food Inc., you know, it was up for an award, one of those documentary awards of some sort. I mean, it got traction and it was a blip on our life for sure. I mean, I'd already written several books. You know, we had a successful farm. We were, you know, we were in that space. But all I can say is it just made a bigger stage for us. It didn't change our message at all, but it definitely changed our credibility in the idea marketplace. It didn't really change actual food sales for us that much. A little, but not a lot. The main thing that it did, it gave us a platform that just gave me a bigger pulpit to preach from, which I'll forever be grateful for. I have a great team. You know, we just keep telling the story and try to be authentic. You know, this space, like anything that starts to gain momentum, people of dubious character are drawn to it. And so we see that in this space as well. And we just try to stay true to what we're doing and for sure keep caressing the land the way we always have. Even though we're much bigger than we were, you know, 10 years ago, the protocols are the same. I think actually we do better today than we did 10 years ago because we have better experience, better skill. And I'm confident that our pigs are happier today than they were 10 years ago, just with better technique, better handling, more experience in how to handle them stress-free if you're going to move them or load them or that sort of thing. And so it's very exciting to just to know that every day you can get a little better. You can always get a little better. You know, about 8 years ago, I was speaking so much. I travel and speak a lot. 8 years ago, I remember I was coming back from a trip and I kind of had an emotional wall. And I said, man, what else is there to talk about? I mean, what am I knowledgeable enough to talk about? Am I going to be stuck with the same phrases, the same words, you know, the rest of my life? And I kind of got this little, like a panic attack, you know, I mean, not totally, but like this little panic attack about, can I continue to grow? And I went home and a couple of days later, I got a request to go speak at a sustainable energy conference. And I'd never spoken at a sustainable energy conference. You know, we're livestock, land, you know, that wasn't our thing. And, you know, I buckled down and I did a keynote speech. And they went nuts over it. And it was like a breakthrough for me. I realized, you know, truth can touch every single facet of the human experience and the human life. And as long as I'm simply applying principles to things, they will always have an application and there will always be a new angle to apply the truth in that type of enterprise, that type of vocation, that type of thing, that country, that different place. And so it really got me over the hump. And now I realize, my goodness, I could never run out of material. You know, there's always new material. I mean, look, if People Magazine can put the Kardashians on the cover for 24 months straight, surely I could come up with new material in food and farming for a while.
One of the things I loved that you said earlier was you said healthy emotionally and in relationship.
Yeah, well, you know, you go to a farm conference like this, and it's all wonderful. We're talking about producing food and selling food and that sort of thing, and it's all wonderful. But at the end of the day, if the home is not a happy place to go into, I don't care how big your cabbage is or how well your tractor runs, if the home is not a haven, nothing else matters. And so when we talk about healthy farmers, the tragedy is right now, actually worldwide, the single highest vocational suicide rate in the world is farmers. That's a tragedy. I mean, look at the lore, the poetry, the legacy of the pastoralist. I mean, it's this wonderful, stress-free, you know, life. And what have we done to ourselves that we have put this level of stress on us? So tending those relationships. So in our family, we have monthly family meetings, because the truth is, you know, family relationships and beyond family, of course, in any relationship, we do say unfit words. We, as Stephen Covey in Seven Habits of Highly Effective People talks about, the emotional gas tank. And I think that's such a wonderful metaphor, that we're having to put enough emotional gas in each other's tanks that when we make that occasional withdrawal, and we will, that we don't empty the tank. And I have a friend that we teach a business school together, Steve Kenyon, and he has this wonderful thing where he says, I wake up in the morning and I think about the people I'm going to interact with that day and tell myself, goody, this is a day I can put emotional equity in their tank. And that's such a wonderful way to think. If we could think about that with our marriages, our families, our kids. And this idea of happiness, health, of emotional, relational vibrancy, it actually takes as much thought and attention as how to have a healthy chicken or a happy pig or a healthy tomato plant. It really does. And I think that we short ourselves, especially in the ag community, because we're so cotton-picking independent, right? And we short ourselves in not being willing to open up about these relational, emotional issues. And so we push them down inside, we push them down inside. And then over time, the kids resent chores, mom and dad resent this, mom resents dad for being, you know, a hard nose, dad resents mom for being a softy. I mean, there's a million different permutations of this. And so our monthly family meeting where we talk, it's not always business. It's let's clear up something. Let's get the perception. Well, I was thinking this. I'm sorry. I didn't have any idea you would have thought that. But, oh, you did think that? Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, I can see now why you would have thought that. Right? And because the truth is that unexpressed expectations are the quickest way for relationships to go sideways. If I have expectations, if I'm expecting you to do something, if I don't tell you, I can't help it if you don't do it, you know. So you can only be responsible for the expectations that you know. And so we've got to be upfront with each other about expectations, and that helps to keep things running smoothly.
I think that's universal in any industry, in any relationship. And thank you for sharing all of that. You touched on foundational principles. Talk to me about what those are for you.
The foundational principles, you know, I'm not a scientist. I'm more a poet than anything. And so as we began looking at how nature works, what we noticed was every ecology is full of animals. There are animals everywhere. And so this notion that we can have these great big, you know, crop farms with no animals is really assaultive of the natural template. So it has animals. There's a fundamentally integration of animals and plants in nature. You don't see plants over here and animals over here. The animals eat the plants in situ, right? The animals aren't confined in factory houses and all the plants brought into them with fertility generated from, you know, from petroleum. The fertility for the plants comes from the manure and the urine from the animals that are cyclical, okay? And so animals, and then next, animals move. They're not locked up. They actually move, which means we needed mobile control because the neighbors don't want them on their place. We needed mobile shelter, mobile water. Fortunately, we have a polyethylene pipe now, so we can get water to any place. And so we use technology, electric fences for control, portable infrastructure. We have all sorts of portable shelters. We have the Millennium Feathernet, the Eggmobile, the Gobbledygo for the turkeys, the Lamborghini for the sheep. I mean, there's all sorts of this portable infrastructure. But, you know, 100 years ago, you couldn't make it because it was too laborious and expensive to mill wood into small pieces. But today, with little, you know, bandsaw mills, we can essentially make tinker toy stuff lightweight enough to be movable. And so there's a wonderful confluence of technology for control, shelter, and water that didn't exist even 80 years ago. And so it's a wonderful time to be able to duplicate the choreography of nature with this movement pattern. And then, you know, nature doesn't move carbon very far. You know, fertility grows in situ. And, you know, leaves blow a little ways. An herbivore eats a plant and goes up on a hilltop and eats it and poops. But, you know, nature doesn't move carbon very far. And so we realize we've got to close our carbon loop. So, you know, we got a big industrial wood chipper, and we started working in the woods and chipping diseased and dead and downed and crooked stuff and upgrading the woodlot and weeding it. And that then allowed us to do large-scale composting, which then drove our fertility program. That was in situ. And then we noticed, you know, nature doesn't have very many annuals. It's primarily perennials. And so, well, how can we handle more perennials? And so, you know, we moved the farm forward in a perennially-based system as opposed to being, you know, crop folks. I mean, we have big garden and that sort of thing. But we let the folks downhill in the valleys grow the crops, and we bring them up to the animals uphill, and that's the way nature always did. The animals ate in the valleys and then walked up to get to see predators on the hilltop, and that's where they pooped and urinated, and that moved all that gravitational fertility from the valleys, it moved it back up on the hillsides, and that was one of the roles of animals in nature. You know, those were just real simple principles that we looked at our farm and said, how do we duplicate these? And as we did, we started having some tremendous success.
Let's talk about your pigs. And pigs are smart, they say.
Oh, yeah. Pigs are the smartest farm animal. There's no doubt about it. That's why they're the most aggravating. Goats are the most mischievous, but goats are not as smart as a pig. Goats just get into trouble. Pigs would be worse than goats, but they spend too much time sleeping. So if goats slept as much time as a pig, they wouldn't get into so much trouble. But the problem with goats is they don't sleep. And so they're just always getting into trouble. Pigs spend... You know, a happy pig will normally spend, 15, 16 hours a day sleeping. So, you know, they're the last animal up in the morning. But yeah, if you're a late riser, you might have been a pig in a previous life.
Anything else you want to talk about with your pigs?
The only thing I'll say about pigs is the number one problem I see in pastured pigs around the world is that people leave them too long at too high a density and do too much damage and not a long enough rest period. Listen, nobody loves the pastured pig concept and doing it as much as I do, but it is a land extensive thing. Now, the beauty of pastured pigs is you don't have to build a house and you don't have to haul poop, all right? So those are big positives. But the negative is that you can't just translate that density of pig in a house with, you know, deep bedding, some sort of a shed or a barn or whatever. You can't just translate that density outside, or you're gonna moonscape thing. You're gonna just tear it up, and it's gonna be an ecological disaster. So what most people don't realize is how much land it takes. And even in our country, you know, we're only running about, you know, 10 pigs per acre. You know, now rotated. You know, they're only on a given spot maybe 5 to 10 days at a time, and then you take them off and you rest it for 60 or 70 days. In this country, you know, maybe you would drop that to 3 and a rest period of 100 days. Now, I don't know, but that's where you have to look at the vegetation, at the ground cover that you want, and then you simply monitor it and you offer the level of disturbance and rest. I mean, it took us 6 or 7 years to finally arrive at a formula that worked in our ecology, in our climate, in our terrain. The formula hasn't been worked out here. And so it just takes some time to monitor and figure out what that is.
Your latest book is on pigs, right?
No, The Marvelous Pigness of Pigs is not about pigs. It's essentially honoring and respecting all of God's creation as if it actually matters. And so it's a fun way to get people to appreciate that it does matter if pigs can express their pigness. That's a very stewardship-oriented thing. You know, we in our culture right now, we don't ask how to make happy pigs. We ask how can we grow them faster? How can we grow them fatter? How can we grow them cheaper? All the fatter, faster, bigger, cheaper. You know, these are the goals. And we don't ask, well, does it matter if the pigs are happy? And in this book, it's essentially it's ecological stewardship for the religious right, if you will. And I would suggest that a culture that refuses to ask, how do we grow happy pigs, will very soon not ask, how do we grow happy people? How do we have happy children? Asking that question creates a moral imperative around our scientific prowess. And, you know, one of our problems as a culture, I think, especially a very highly sophisticated technological culture, is that we're very good about how to. We can solve almost anything, but as technicians, we're not drilling down on the why. So we can do things. My dad used to call this overrunning our headlights. We can create things that we can't morally, physically, emotionally, or mentally metabolize. And so we create things like feeding dead cows to cows for 30 years, and then we have bovine spongiform encephalopathy. That was very creative, how to grind up a cow and feed it back to a cow in a way that a cow would eat, that an herbivore would eat carrion. Wow, that's very creative. But it was completely against the cowness of the cow. And I was laughed at for 30 years for daring to question progressive science and what we can do until the day we had Mad Cow. And then suddenly I wasn't so stupid anymore. And I didn't oppose it, not because I hated science or didn't want progress. I opposed it because I looked around the planet and said, where's the herbivore that eats carrion? I mean, at her most fundamental state, a cow is an herbivore. She's not just inanimate protoplasmic structure to be manipulated, however clever Huber's can imagine to manipulate it. She's a cow, you know, and she's an herbivore. And so order, natural order design, that should act as a boundary, if you will, over what we can do. The movie Jurassic Park, you know, everything's going into mayhem. And the scientist, of course, civilization's getting ready to be destroyed. He's still euphoric over his development. And the journalist, of course, you know, as a writer, I have a very soft heart for journalists, okay? The journalist, you know, gets in the scientist's face. He says, but sir, just because we can, should we? That is the pregnant statement of the entire movie. That is the deal. And I think we as a culture don't ask ourselves that much. We just say, how can we do this? We don't ask, well, should we?
I asked Joel his take on urban farming, and specifically how someone, perhaps even a newer farmer, could utilize a small plot of land for small-scale farming.
Very small acreage farms are absolutely viable today. I would say perhaps the most viable they've ever been in history, because we do have drip tape irrigation, we have broad forks, we have, you know, transplant things, we have hoop houses. Goodness, I ran into a guy from Kenya who had gotten a bunch of salvaged 24-inch culverts and cut them in 12-foot pieces and took an acetylene torch and torched pockets in them, tamped them full of soil and compost, and planted cabbage and Brussels sprouts in these pockets on these 24-inch vertical tubes. He was essentially growing, I think it was 25 acres worth of broccoli and cabbage on 1 acre of land. And he had a little drip tape, you know, in the top of each one. We have not been able to do that in history. And so the ability to have these extremely intensive, stackable companion planting techniques now makes actually small acreages. I mean, this was, there's actually a name for this developed in British Columbia called spin farming. It's all about under like 2 acre farms. And it's absolutely a trend that's moving in the urban sector and in the near urban fringe. And we can just be really thankful that we have water delivery systems and season extension systems that are so far beyond a bucket and a cold frame that we had, you know, 80 years ago.
You said 70% of all food on the planet is produced on farms smaller than 10 acres.
Yeah, that's correct. We tend to think these big, you know, great big farms are where everything is produced, but that's not the case. I mean, in Italy, the average farm is 7.5 acres, and that's why all the walk-behind tillers, a little like BCSs, little garden tractors, they're all made in Italy, because that's the tractor of a very small acreage. And you can make round bales and mow hay and rake and basically everything that you can do with a great big tractor with a little hand tractor. And of course, Africa, Central America, most places, a lot of this food's produced there. I mean, as recently as 1946, 40% of all produce in America was grown in backyard gardens in 1946. That's not that long ago. And so in the uberization of the food system, part of it is going to be the uberization of the farming system too, that with this really cool technology we have now with little, you know, walk-behind tractors and tillers and the kind of stuff that Ben Hartman is doing, the kind of stuff that Elliot Coleman has been doing. We're seeing now increased viability for small-space food production occupation. At our farm, we have these all this portable, you know, the Eggmobiles and the portable chicken shelters and stuff. And I know people that have a quarter-acre suburban backyard, and they have one of these chicken shelters, and they move the chickens around in the yard. They produce their own food. They become the number one babysitter for all the kids in the community. They get off the bus. They don't go watch cartoons on TV. Now they run and they sit on 5 gallon buckets and watch the chickens, you know. And so there's all these cool social community connections that develop when we bring food proximate to consumption.
I also heard you say in the next 15 years, 50% of America's agriculture equity is going to change hands. Will you elaborate? Because this is fascinating.
Sure. Well, what that means is right now, the average American farmer is 60 years old. And that age has been going up about 3 to 4 months a year for the past 20 to 25 years. It's just been gradually growing. In Japan, it's even worse. It's 70. They lead the world in the farmer. You know, what's the average age of the average farmer? If the average age is 60, that means half are already over 60, okay? And so by 75, they're going to be, and a lot of them are over 65, over 70. So in the next 15 years, 50% of the buildings, the land, and the equipment in agriculture will be owned by someone else. That has never happened in any civilization in peace. It's only happened in conquest. Now, I'm not here predicting we're going to be in conquest. I am just suggesting, though, that this is an epochal disruption in the agrarian sector of a culture. The obvious question is, well, where's it going to go? Now, obviously, most of it will be inherited, but it will be inherited by children who don't want to farm. And so then what will happen then? Do they sell it? Does it get leased to Monsanto or Cargill or you know, whatever? I don't know. I can only tell you what I would like to see. I would like to see it go to a new generation of bright-eyed, bushy-tailed entrepreneurial millennials who will take that land and caress it like it hasn't been caressed for a long time and market integrity, nutrient-dense food to their locales and heal the land and heal the communities.
Well, I so appreciate you taking the time to meet with me and chat with me.
Thank you for your interest in these issues. It's a special thing to put time on these issues. We need to be doing that. We need to be having these discussions because they're the staff of life.
From lean farming to Joel's Millennium Feathernet, these two farmers have some serious insight on what the future holds for farming and what it takes to be a successful and happy farmer. For my full interview with Joel Salatin, please visit kvnf.org. For KVNF, I'm Corey Stanton. Thank you for listening.